So thinking more about kind of not just will the person in the 5 minutes that they first turn on the screen and experience this or put on the goggles or whatever, what will that kind of impact be? But if you multiply that, you know, times millions or billions of people and think about that, how that'll change behaviors and change incentives and things like that, and what does that look like? That to me is the more exciting thing. But the stuff I really think about and I hope companies will think about is if you play the short-term individual experience out over millions or billions of people over a longer term, what does that look like? That to me is what the kind of, you know, most important question is.
Hello and welcome to Digital Mindfulness. The person you are listening to is Charles Penner, and he's a partner at Jhana Partners, an investment management firm that focuses on enhancing value within companies via shareholder engagement. In this episode, Charlie discusses the reasons behind and the subsequent impact of the now famous letter petitioning Apple to create products that are less distracting and have an overall net positive impact on children and society. In this episode, you're going to learn the role of activist shareholders in raising awareness of the importance of responsible technology development, why responsible innovation leads to greater value creation for companies, and the potential impact of responsible technologies on global society in the near future. But before we start, welcome to Digital Mindfulness. Here we help you understand the complex ethical technology landscape and how it can be used to impact your life. Here on the show, we've got some fantastic new insights ready to share with you on everything from the attention economy to digital well-being, ethical technologies, humane design, and much, much more. Check out our website for regular updates on the complimentary webinars that we run on all of these topics and more, and also for further ways that you can take deep dives with us and really get to know these fascinating industries that are developing. Okay, so now please enjoy this interview with Charlie Penner. Charlie, welcome to the show. It's fantastic to have you here on Digital Mindfulness, and I'm really looking forward to our discussion. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Charlie, for people that are meeting you for the first time, tell us a little bit, if you would, about yourself and about Jhana Partners.
Sure. So I'll start with Jhana. Jhana's been around since 2001. We are best known for being a shareholder activist, which means that we invest in public companies and try to get them to do things that will create more value for shareholders. About a year ago, we announced that we would be pursuing an additional strategy, which would be an extension of that, basically, which is getting companies to focus on environmental and social issues that they can be doing better in ways that would accrue to the long-term benefit of shareholders as well as society and the economy and the planet, depending on what the particular company is. So I've been here since 2005, working on the kind of strategic and communications aspects of our activist efforts. And I will be helping to run, co-running this new fund that will be focused on long-term environmental and social issues and kind of the intersection of getting companies to change their corporate behavior in ways that are better for everyone in the long run, and that also make them more valuable companies. So looking for situations where you can combine those two things, which we think there are plenty of, and it's in most cases that'll be true.
I think I'd really love it, Charlie, if you can just talk a little bit more about this fund in a bit more depth, because I've got a lot of questions about this, but in particular the whole idea that if a company is socially and environmentally responsible, and particularly as we're going to be talking about companies such as Apple, then this directly relates to increased shareholder value.
Sure. So the types of things we've typically focused on have been more near-term events. So it can be at a company that has an underperforming division that maybe, you know, would be more valuable for or spun off, or maybe they need additional expertise on their board, or perhaps they need to recapitalize the balance sheet, and things that will have a near-term, we hope, value-creating impact that will endure for the longer term. you know, as the world gets to be a more complicated place, the types of issues that were more typically the purview of, you know, for lack of a better term, the kind of, you know, environmental social governance community or social responsible investing community, the distance between what traditional shareholders care about and what the ESG community cared about, we see is really kind of narrowing to the point where it makes sense for traditional shareholders like ourselves to be focused on these issues. I mean, the most obvious example is climate change, you know, where it's apparent to all but the most kind of stubborn companies today that it's not a good thing over the long term if you have factories flooding the other kind of more dire consequences of climate change. But in other areas like, you know, growing income inequality, you know, we've had, you know, 40 plus years of, you know, kind of widening disparity in terms of incomes for folks. And, you know, as part of that, companies have really underinvested in people. And now some of the smartest, most forward-thinking companies, and even in the private equity space, you know, they're realizing that the return on investing in people and actually treating them as more than cannon fodder over the long term is great. And same thing, you know, with what we call responsible technological development, which is, you know, we went through a period where kind of anything that an engineer could come up with, you know, was kind of greeted as, wow, that's great. Now I can do this and I can do that. And it kind of removes any friction to whatever obstacle the technology was meant to address. But, you know, I don't have to tell you, recently there's been, you know, a very deep kind of reexamination of if we're getting really the benefit of the bargain when it comes to a lot of new technologies, and not just in the sense of how it makes us feel on a kind of day-to-day basis, but also where it's taking society for the long term. So the basic idea was, these are things that maybe aren't issues, you know, next week or even next quarter for a company, but over the long term, but still within an investable time horizon, these are the questions that will really kind of make a big difference. I mean, as the market has evolved over the years, you know, most of the value in public companies these days are in intangibles, whether it's brand value, the value of your workforce. And so these are kind of the big questions, if you answer correctly, can really create a lot of long-term value, and also obviously hopefully make the world a better place. And hopefully those two things go together, which is what we're focused on.
I think, Charlie, I think this is just, this is completely fascinating, because it's almost an extension of what we would traditionally think of corporate social responsibility. And I think it's outstanding that Jhana Partners is really taking a meaningful role in this. So I wonder if you could now just talk really to the actual Apple activism, and particularly the genesis in there. So once this new fund was created and you had an idea of strategically how you wanted to go about this, why was it Apple in particular that was the company that you thought, right, we're going to set our sights here first?
Yeah, they were, we thought it was the best initial company to focus on for a few reasons. One, you know, we wanted to focus where we thought we could have the biggest impact. And, you know, I think a lot of people confuse that with us saying we thought Apple was the worst kind of tech player out there, which is not true, and I think far from it. But, you know, the basic idea was that, you know, if you think of kind of the flood of you know, apps and other technologies kind of out there, you know, the iPhone and the iPad is one of the primary conduits through which that kind of comes through. So the image I always refer to is, if, you know, if you're concerned about something that's coming out of a hose, you can, you know, try to catch all the water that's coming out of the hose, or you can squeeze the hose. And so the basic idea you know, thinking about kids, which was the focus of the campaign, and the screen, if you can actually have something that acts as a tool for parents to better kind of modulate what's coming through it, that's the most impactful place to start. I think the second thing was that, you know, Apple is a leader in pretty much every respect of the word. In terms at least of the U.S., most teenagers who have a smartphone have an Apple smartphone. In terms of, you know, the industry kind of following their lead, you know, Apple, you know, announced that they would be improving the controls and you know, Google for the Android, you know, followed shortly thereafter. So it was not meant to point the finger of blame or to kind of, you know, rank companies by levels of fault. This isn't, at least in my mind, about pointing fingers. It was about saying, look, you're in an incredible opportunity to do something to really help people here. And by the way, it's very conducive to your business model. And as we said, Apple is not a company that, you know, relies on people overusing their devices. Which is not something necessarily you can say about, you know, like a social media company, at least in their current form. So it just seemed like a very logical first place to begin. In terms of, you know, the genesis of the campaign, I mean, I'll tell you honestly, the initial genesis was really just worrying about kids and, you know, I've kids, and also just kind of what society would be like when they were adults. And, you know, for years, just kind of looking around and seeing what I think are kind of the negative impacts of, you know, people getting their information from sources that aren't necessarily always reliable or putting things in context, people getting used to communicating in ways that don't lend themselves to, you know, kind of empathy. People just being kind of lost in a haze of you know, digital distraction, and just thinking 20, 30 years down the road, how much better it would be if people had grown up with phones that, you know, for example, you got, you know, 20 or 30 minutes a day of, you know, Facebook or Instagram or whatever, or, you know, that didn't even work at dinner time. So you didn't even bother to bring it to the table because it never worked, or you didn't sleep with it under your pillow because it didn't work at night. Or, you know, there are a limited number of social media sites because the research shows that the more you use, the more likely you are to be depressed as a young person. Basically phones that were kind of had training wheels on them so that when you grew up, you could ride a bike responsibly, to kind of stretch the analogy to the breaking point. So it wasn't really, at least initially, about anything kind of currently happening. It was just thinking about, wouldn't we all be better off as a society if 20, 30 years down the road, people were better able to kind of moderate their tech usage and use it more responsibly. The more immediate impact of phones, though, was really something that there's a professor at San Diego State, Jean Twenge, T-W-E-N-G-E, but it's pronounced Twenge. She had done a lot of really good work showing the negative mental health impacts in you know, the present on some of the heaviest young smartphone users. So it was really kind of combining those two strains and then saying, you know, look, I would certainly feel much better about the phones if they had more dynamic and robust controls for parents. I'm a consumer. There's probably a nexus here. And so kind of working that into the business model of Apple, which really felt like kind of a natural fit.
I think the thing that really struck me when, you know, when reading all of the material that I could about this was the idea that it wasn't necessarily, you know, you weren't just lambasting Apple by saying, you know, like, you've got to change this and we're going to hold placards. It's more the fact that, you know, and I'm just quoting verbatim here, that Apple should be thinking more deeply about how to give families more options in terms of how to guide children and adolescents to use their devices, because not only is that going to be useful for the customers, but also it's going to enhance Apple's offering to people by giving them content and products that are more in keeping with positive well-being.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think in some ways, actually, it's more relevant today than it was when the letter came out a year ago, because the issue that Apple has, which I think they will successfully address, but, you know, the real controversy now around Apple is, will they be able to transition from a company that, you know, sells you hardware, to one that, you know, is really valued, for the strength of its ecosystem, and actually able to directly monetize that beyond just when you buy a new phone. And obviously that's the direction they want to go. The challenge obviously they have is that, you know, when you use your phone, you're using a lot of third-party technology, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or video game or whatever. The more of that Apple can actually make proprietary to them, which they don't have a lot of. I mean, you know, it's even, you know, music isn't, you know, terribly proprietary. And the other things, you know, they're working on, I think they will get there. And I think they are making a lot of strides in that direction. But, you know, one of the things I think will be important as time goes on is also making people feel safe and supported, that there's something special about the Apple iOS and broader ecosystem where they feel safe and supported within it. I mean, if you look at kind of the history of companies that make hardware that you stick in your pocket, it's littered with bodies. I think Apple has successfully avoided that to date because there is something special about the Apple ecosystem. But I think part of that going forward will also be these kind of enhanced protections and showing that it's not just, you know, whatever the bare minimum kind of parental controls are, but really kind of saying, you know, we partner with the best experts. You know, we partner with the experts to kind of develop the technology so that, you know, if we're offering you this choice, it's because research has shown that this is actually, you know, an important choice to offer parents. And when we're, you know, helping to develop the research and we're helping provide, you know, parents information about how to interact with their kids around, you know, moderating their use of technology, which is also really important. Kind of, you know, developing that as part of their identity. And this was, we thought, a really great first step to doing that, and hope it will continue because we do think it will, you know, really accrue to the benefit of the company over the long term.
I think for my part, I really like the emphasis that you put, that you just mentioned there, on collaborating with different experts. And again, within the letter saying that it's important for companies like this to be abreast of all of the best research and the kind of most cutting edge research. And I'm wondering, Charlie, with all of the different updates that we get constantly to our phones and to our technology ecosystem, do you think that companies are almost incorporating this type of research in with their updates? Do you see extra changes now, like kind of with the year that's passed since the campaign launched?
You know, we spoke to a lot of people in addition to, you know, Professor Twenge and also Dr. Michael Rich at Harvard and Boston Children's to help develop the letter. And I know that a lot of those people post the letter and, you know, other things that happened last year, got called into kind of, you know, meetings and asked for their input in ways they had not previously been done. So that's anecdotal, but, I certainly hope so, because, you know, one of the things that was really astonishing when the letter came out, you know, we were on CNBC, and for whatever reason, CNBC had a bee in their bonnet about, our letter. And so they're saying, well, they already have parental controls. Look, you can just swipe things on and off. And it was just so, you know, anybody who had spent any time even just reading some articles about this knew that that was exactly what the research would tell you you don't want. The kids who you just kind of yank it out of their hands or turn off their screens, they're the ones who actually then when they do get access to it, they go wild and start looking for, you know, pornography or pretending to be other people. And what you want is to be able to kind of set optimal usage, you know, time limits and times a day and things like that. So, that's a very simple example, but the amount of you know, benefit that companies can realize by actually partnering with the people who research these things, which sounds really obvious, but has not at least historically been happening, certainly does seem to be happening more, and I think it'd be very smart you know, for companies to do that.
Charlie, one fascinating thing that you mentioned was the whole idea of Apple's real strength, in addition to their products, is their ecosystem. And the idea that people feel safe and supported within their ecosystem. So as companies, or if companies adopt more digital well-being practices and engineering and designing in their products and services, do you see that having wider marketplace value?
Certainly in the long term. I mean, you know, there's always this, the tension, and it's not just technology. I think it's wider tension in the market, and it's one of the ones that we're really, I think, creates the opportunity for us, which is, you know, the basic idea that you can do something that people like in the short term, but over the long term start to realize they're not so happy with. You know, Adam Alter at NYU, you know, talks about kind of the distinction between the like center of your brain and the want center of your brain. And, you know, the like center is very fickle, and the want is very attached. So, you know, part of the idea, I think, behind a lot of technologies these days, they're playing to the want center, which is, you know, I want the, you know, the variable rewards, or I want, you know, something that kind of my brain starts to kind of hunger. But after a while, you realize you don't really like it. And so then you set up this tension between, well, am I going to, you know, stop using this, or I just use it begrudgingly and still kind of hate it. Our opinion is that over the long term, it makes more sense to develop technologies that people both want and like over the long term. And it certainly seems to be where at least the smartest tech companies are going. You don't hear, I think, at least in my experience now, you know, companies bragging about, you know, that they make slot machines for your brain, or call, you know, new companies coming out with names like Dopamine Labs or things like that. So it certainly seems like, at least cosmetically, where companies realize that they need to be headed, and hopefully substantively as well. But one of the things that we'll be working on going forward is really trying to kind of, you know, impress the importance of being authentic about it to companies.
Do you think, I mean, you know, I guess in the last year that in the year since that the letters come out, we've seen so many changes in relation to this landscape we've been speaking about, and you know, everything from information warfare all the way over to kind of companies losing shareholder value with regards to lost data and data hacks. And I'm wondering, Charlie, just kind of putting your crystal ball into play, but how, if companies again were to just even start incorporating a little of every of the kind of digital wellness principles that you were talking about in the letter, how do you see kind of the next 10 years of for the technology landscape?
Well, you know, hopefully they'll think about it in as you say, in kind of 10-year, you know, kind of, or 10 or 10 plus year, you know, kind of time periods. You know, I think that the thing about technology that we tried to emphasize is that, you know, it really can shape people. And that's obviously not a brilliant insight. Marshall McLuhan said it decades ago. But I think, you know, one of the things about, you know, kind of that always strikes me about the term, like kind of, you know, digital well-being or tech addictions or those things, is it's very kind of inward looking and kind of doesn't really as much reflect kind of the wider societal impact. You know, so for example, I'm not addicted to Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. I've never even used them, but I feel like they've had a big impact on my life and the world that I live in. And I'm sure there are other people who feel the same way. So thinking more about kind of not just will the person in the 5 minutes that they first turn on the screen and experience this or put on the goggles or whatever, what will that kind of impact be? But if you multiply that, you know, times millions or billions of people and think about that, how that'll change behaviors and change incentives and things like that, and what does that look like? That to me is the more exciting thinking. And I'll confess, me personally, I'm more of a kind of just technology avoider. So I haven't focused a whole lot on, you know, what adults with fully developed brains can be doing to better utilize technology, probably as much as I should. But the stuff I really think about, and I hope companies will think about, is if you play the short-term individual experience out over millions or billions of people over a longer term, what does that look like? That to me is what the kind of, you know, most important question is.
It's interesting because that was going to be one of my questions actually. Not so much why children and kids, but almost would that be another focus for the company, kind of looking at the impacts of technology on adult brains and et cetera.
Yeah, it's so, I mean, I'm not going to tell you about it because obviously you know way more than I do about it, but it just seems like such a trickier question. The focus for kids was honestly just waking up in terror at night thinking about what the world would look like for our kids. And that had been something that had been going on for years. And, you know, not to get political, but, you know, within the last couple of years, it certainly hasn't become less of a concern. But, you know, for adults, I feel like I'm not sure what to do about kind of the current situation or how you take somebody whose brain is fully developed, but is being negatively impacted by, you know, this kind of onslaught of technologies. And you see it, you know, not just, you know, with kids, but, you know, older people who can't put their phones away at dinner or, you know, have their kind of view of the world skewed one way or the other because of the weird way now that they get information. It's such a more difficult kind of debate, I think, about kind of personal responsibility versus corporate responsibility. The thing about the issue with kids was not only was it kind of the main, at least fear, but it's just such, you can't really debate the other side of it. People tried, but Apple even itself couldn't really debate it. You have somebody whose brain is still developing. They have no developed sense of, you know, self-worth or confidence or empathy. And, you know, just handing them this thing with a bionic chip in it that gives them access to every possible thing in the world all at once, and giving them the same phone that you give a 40 or 50 year old. It was just such an easy debate. I mean, there's a reason why, you know, Apple came out the next day and said, yeah, we're going to work on this. It wasn't because they were scared of us. I mean, we were a fly they could have easily swatted away, but it just wasn't a debate that you could really take the other side of with any credibility. Whereas, you know, when you're talking about technology that's used by adults, I think there's still a winning side of that debate, but it's just a much more nuanced and you know, difficult argument to kind of to make.
You talked about impact there, and, you know, you said that you're comparatively, you know, like you're a fly that Apple would swat away, you know, but actually it's great that they took this seriously and started to work on it. But I know, of course, with the work that you've done, you've obviously gotten much, much more press and newsworthiness than, say, a research article would coming from a newspaper. So I'm interested to know what your perceptions are on the role of the investor community in, again, raising awareness, bringing forward these kind of positive changes within the tech industry.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You know, when I was talking about, you know, our kind of relative size compared to Apple, you know, it was really just a reflection of, at the time, at least, Apple was a roughly $900 billion market cap company. And we, together with CalSTRS, the California State Teacher Retirement System, we owned about $2 billion worth of stock. So obviously a lot of money, but relative to their market cap, not a lot. But in terms of being able to shine a different kind of spotlight on it, that was really kind of the difference maker. So, I, you know, I think the thing that was so novel to people about it is that you're not used to hearing shareholders complain about negative impacts, obviously, on kids' mental health. So the thing that was interesting about it, which is, yeah, there had already been a lot of research, certainly on negative impacts of social media in some cases, and obviously going back further, video games, and even, you know, before that, other kind of sedentary screen-based activities. So a lot of what we were saying wasn't new, other than highlighting the developing research that, no surprise, the thing that's the major conduit for all those things can also lead to the same results. But what we were able to add to it was, hey, this is actually something investors care about. And this is something that actually, you know, a big pension fund and a well-established shareholder activist care about. And as the company, you know, calls their shareholders and you know, says, well, what do you think about this? Having them say, yeah, why wouldn't you do this? This makes sense. That's what we were really able to kind of bring to the debate. So you're right. The nice thing about this is if we do it right, it adds not just another voice, because there's certainly lots of voices out there and they're all really important, but it adds a voice coming from, you know, a quarter that people aren't expecting to have these concerns. And it really kind of, you know, the there's this kind of, I think, annoying kind of hard-headed, practical, supposed approach where people say, well, sorry, but, you know, the hard-headed, practical thing to do is to keep, you know, pulling carbon out of the ground. We have no choice but to drive humanity off a cliff. that's not hard-headed or practical. It's just really short-term. So being able to kind of reframe it as, you know, look, even if you just look at this from a kind of practical business perspective, this is what makes sense to do over the long term. That's what we were able to add that was kind of new to it, even though the underlying concerns and harms obviously had been the subject of research for a long time.
I think this is fantastic. And, you know, it's a shame we've got to end the interview here, but I think there are going to be lots and lots of people who have other questions for you. So thanks so much for spending time with us today. It's been incredibly illuminating. And yeah, thanks for sharing your time and wisdom with us.
Thanks again for having me.